The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Filipina journalist Maria Ressa has been hounded and arrested by her government. It has not stopped her crucial reporting.
Maria has always taught us that the way you fight back is just by doing your work.
Work that landed her a Nobel Peace Prize today. I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show today, Newcastle soccer fans are dancing in the streets despite the notorious reputation of the club's new owners.
It seems anyone is acceptable, provided they come heavily armed with cash.
And we'll find out who or what helped compose this. Beethoven's unfinished 10th Symphony finished at last. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
Hello.
Am I talking to Maria Ressa?
You are, yes.
It's the call few people ever get, and most are shocked when they do. Today, that included Filipina journalist Maria Ressa.
My God, this is, I'm speechless. Thank you so very much.
Today, Ressa, along with Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. It is the first time it's gone to a journalist since 1935. Ressa was cited for her work with Rappler, the news site she co-founded in 2012. It has relentlessly and bravely put the policies of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte under the spotlight, including the large-scale killings linked to a police campaign against drugs. Sofia Tomacruz is a journalist at Rappler. She works with Maria Ressa. Congratulations, first of all, Sofia. What is your reaction to today's news?
Thank you so much. You know, the news is such good news. It came after a really long week here in the Philippines. I'm not sure if you're aware, but election season is in full swing. So it was such a surprise for us. I mean, not only for Maria, but for us too. But really, it could not have come at a better time.
It has been a long week there. We're covering the final list of candidates today, in fact, on the show. Sofia, what does it mean to you that the Nobel Committee has awarded the Peace Prize to journalists this year?
I think that the fact that the Nobel Peace Prize awarded it to journalists this year is just really a recognition of journalism's role in the world today, especially at this time. You know, in the past few years, we've seen how important it is to defend press freedom and hold the line, as Maria would say, against those who want to weaken that. And no matter how small or unassuming their actions may be, it's so important that we shine a light on people who try to silence us. And the award really highlights the struggles of journalists, I think, not only in the Philippines, but across the world. And so really, this prize, like I said, really just could not have come at a better time.
Briefly, what are the ways Rappler and Maria Ressa have been silenced or attempted to have been silenced over the past few years?
Right. So especially under the current administration, there's been just several cases thrown at Rappler, in particular against Maria Ressa. And I think in total, there have been about 11 cases, 7 still active against her. So you can just imagine how much time that takes and how much time it takes away from us reporters, you know, when it comes to doing our jobs.
And are those 7 cases kind of affecting your ability to keep Rappler going?
You know, Maria and the rest of our bosses do such a good job at making sure that we keep doing the work that we're doing. And I think it just really goes back to what Maria would always tell us, you know, the way that you fight back is how you do your job as a journalist. And they really made it a point to drill that into us and every day. And I think something that we like to remind ourselves of as well. So Maria has always taught us that the way you fight back is just by doing your work and doing it to the best of your abilities.
Mm. The prize, as we know, went to Maria Ressa and Rappler, but also to Dmitry Muratov of Novaya Gazeta in Moscow. Generally, Sophia, what is the relationship between Rappler and any other organizations around the globe doing the same kind of risky journalism you do?
I think the relationship would be that in Russia and in the Philippines, there are many similarities. Both media industries in both countries are being attacked. Both are being targeted by the government. And so, you know, it's also something that Maria says, right? You can't just speak out when you're affected. You need to speak out, even if it's your peers, even if it's somebody far away, because the moment that you allow it to happen in one place, then it gives permission for other leaders and for other people to do it, to weaken a free press in other places. And so we need to protect one another, no matter how far away we are from each other. And what happens in one place, it won't stop there. You know, the prize being given to both Maria and Dmitry, it's really a testament to how truth prevails, I think, and how even in places that are trying to stifle the truth, it'll always come out.
Has there been any reaction from the Philippine government to the Nobel Peace Prize for Rappler and Maria Ressa?
No, radio silence so far.
Sophia Toma Cruz is a colleague of Maria Ressa's at the Philippine news site Rappler. Maria Ressa is one of two journalists to win this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Sophia, thank you very much and congratulations to the team at Rappler.
Thank you.
Journalist Maria Ressa is one of many Filipinos targeted by Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. Duterte's regime is blamed for more than 6,000 deaths in the name of his war on drugs. But Duterte's term is soon coming to an end, and though he's still popular, by law he's not allowed to run for another term. Today was the deadline to register for the candidates hoping to replace him. Reporter Ashley Westerman is keeping tabs on this much-anticipated election and joins us now. Welcome, Ashley.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
So who will Filipinos be voting for president in May of next year?
So, Marco, I have a question. Have you ever heard of Manny Pacquiao?
Of course, the boxer.
Yes. So that guy, he's running. Another name you might know is Marcos. Bongbong Marcos is running. He's the son of the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Mm. And finally, current vice president and opposition leader Lenny Robredo. Her time as Duterte's VP has been tumultuous because they fundamentally have different beliefs on issues. So she'll be casting herself as an alternative to the last 6 years, particularly when it comes to managing the pandemic. And I want to mention one more candidate, and that's Senator Bota de la Rosa. He's a political ally of Duterte and the former police chief who helped carry out the president's deadly war on drugs.
Ashley, I thought there was another player running here. Duterte's daughter was going to throw her hat in the ring, no?
Yes, that's Sara Duterte, the current mayor of the city of Davao. She's saying she wants to win re-election as mayor, but her father keeps telling the press that she's going to run for president, so it's unclear.
On some level, Ashley, let's face it, a lot of elections are popularity contests, but I can't help but think that the world champion boxer Manny Pacquiao actually has a real advantage here. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, this guy has 12 major world titles, but people in the Philippines also know him as a politician for over a decade. He's been a representative and a senator, and until recently, he was closely aligned with President Duterte, who remains very popular. But even though everyone knows Pacquiao's name and he has a rags-to-riches story many can relate to, he actually didn't do much with his time in office.
Now, moving to Bongbong Marcos, the son of the former dictator Ferdinand Marcos, what's been the reaction to the dictator's son running for president now?
Yes, Bongbong's father was a strongman who ruled the Philippines between 1966 and 1986. It was a dark time. The Philippines was under martial law for nearly a decade. Political opponents were jailed. And the Marcos family is accused of stealing some $10 billion from government coffers. But all of that recent history is sort of being rewritten right now, says the political analyst Victor Manheed. And that's especially true on social media.
We've seen since 2016 a lot of misinformation with regards to the story, facts, figures of the Marcos years.
Manheed says Bongbong doesn't really have any defining moments to his political career up to this point, other than his last name.
You know, we've seen so many authoritarian types try and change the constitution of their country so they can run for a term not mandated in the constitution. Should we be surprised that Duterte, Rodrigo Duterte, did not try that?
So, Marco, he actually did try that earlier in his administration. He tried to drum up support for changing the constitution so he could run for another term. And the Filipino people are so traumatized because of the Marcos regime history that Duterte's effort to change the constitution so he could run again just never really got off the ground.
Actually, I know it's super early. The election isn't until next May, but any idea who Filipinos are already favoring?
One recent poll says Sara Duterte, remember, she's not even running for president yet, is in the lead.
Wow.
With Bongbong and Pacquiao polling somewhere in the top four, and opposition leader Lenny Robredo didn't even crack the top five. So it's going to be exciting to see who in this star-studded presidential race can convince the Filipino people they have the answer to these really big problems, like managing the pandemic and the country's economic recovery. So it will be super interesting to follow in the coming months, Marco.
Reporter Ashley Westerman, thank you very much for breaking it down for us.
Thank you.
Something is starting to shift with the pandemic, specifically in many of the places that have long embraced very strict containment strategies. This change may point to a new stage in this era of COVID. The World's Alana Gordon reports.
Some of the countries with the lowest number of infections and deaths in this pandemic, like remarkably low, have what's called a zero COVID strategy. Think lockdowns, widespread testing, rigorous contact tracing, mandatory quarantines, restricted travel, even enforced by police. Dr. Zane Chagla is an infectious disease professor at McMaster University in Canada. He says the appeal of these strategies is that when COVID-19 gets to zero, everything opens up.
The places that did it, you know, when the times worked, they went through a long period of lockdown, but then they had a long period of normalcy, even without vaccinations.
China, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, New Zealand are all places that have adopted this approach. In many cases, it's been popular, but up to a point. Australia was another one. Jane Halton is the country's former Secretary of Health.
I think what all of the countries who've been successful to date have also had in common is that they've struggled to contain Delta.
With Delta, the country put in some of the harshest lockdowns in the world.
It's quite a psychological hurdle. Because in an environment where life looks like it looked in the middle of 2019, the notion that all of a sudden you're going to be in some way constrained, that is a very, very difficult bridge to cross.
Now, many places are realizing that zero COVID may have worked well in the beginning of this pandemic, but it's not sustainable. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
I think increasingly there's a recognition that it's incredibly difficult to rid from the planet this virus, or certainly even bring it down to levels that would qualify it for elimination.
Elimination was important because we didn't have vaccines. Now we do.
New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, just announced the country is phasing out a COVID zero strategy. The country was a model for the strategy and had gone months without any cases. But Delta still snuck in, putting Auckland in lockdown for weeks. Now, Ardern says they have to accept a certain number of cases.
So we can begin to change the way we do things. We have more options, and there's good cause for us to feel optimistic about the future.
This month, Australia announced it's also moving away from COVID zero in phases as they race to get more people vaccinated. But the transition is still complicated. It means figuring out how to respond to a certain level of infections. Ashley St. John is a researcher at Duke NUS, a collaboration at the National University of Singapore.
The idea was that if we could get above 80% vaccination, which has now been achieved, there would be a shift towards easing the rules and regulations.
But a lot of those regulations are still in place. She says people in Singapore are now wondering why the restrictions are there when those vaccination goals have been met. The country's still wrestling with Delta outbreaks, though vaccines are preventing severe illnesses and deaths.
So I think there's been some hesitancy with regards to shifting the strategy, even though, you know, the messaging is that the strategy of living with COVID hasn't changed.
China is an outlier. It's sticking with a zero COVID strategy of putting a hammer to even one infection. But for much of the world, the hope is that now, with effective vaccines, the virus can begin to turn into something that's more like the flu, where the risks of getting really sick are lower. There is a big catch to all of this. Here's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Not to have equitable distribution of vaccines is not only a question of being immoral, it is also a question of being stupid.
He says countries can't just focus on themselves, so long as big swaths of the world lack vaccines and the virus continues to spread. That puts everyone at greater risk for new variants that could set all these efforts back. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
You are listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 3 years ago, Abdulrahman Al-Sadan was taken into custody, some say kidnapped, by Saudi Arabian authorities while he was at work in Riyadh. Al-Sadan was a humanitarian aid worker and had been critical of the Saudi government on Twitter. His imprisonment and trial were secretive. On Wednesday, a Saudi appeals court upheld his 20-year sentence and also added on a 20-year travel ban. Al-Sadan's sister, Arij Al-Sadan, works for a technology company in the Bay Area and joins us from her home in California. Arij Al-Sadan, what exactly was the crime Saudi authorities charged your brother with?
Basically for expressing his opinions on Twitter. It was a list of vague charges that doesn't make any sense. And it's all basically under the umbrella of what the Saudi call fighting terrorism. And if you look closely at what the Saudi government consider terrorism, is criticizing the Saudi rulers will be considered terrorism. Mm.
And you were saying the two of you have been out of touch for the entire time he's been in prison thus far.
For me here in the States, even for my mom, who's also an American, we couldn't get to speak to him or see him at all. He's completely barred from any calls or visits. And even during the hearings, he was limited from contacting his lawyer.
Abdulrahman's sentence of 20 years has now been augmented with a 20-year travel ban, which means your brother will be well into his 70s before he can leave the kingdom. How are you and your family taking this news?
It's just crazy. It's inhumane, unbelievable. Why would they do that for criticism, for tweets, you know, over tweets? It's just crazy. And of course, we're very upset. It's very painful. My mom has been suffering a lot as a result of this. She hasn't spoken to her son, and my brother was very close to my mom. He always checks on her. He's very loving and caring to all of us, but especially to a mother. This is very hard to be deprived from, you know, speaking to her son or seeing him. And on top of that, hearing all the details of torture and enforced disappearance and mistreatment, it is just terrible. And nobody should accept that.
The U.S. State Department says it is concerned about the mistreatment your brother was subjected to and that his fair trial guarantees were not respected. How has your family been dealing with the lack of transparency in Abdulrahman's case? How do you get accurate information?
Luckily, there are different witnesses from the earliest of days, like when Khashoggi got assassinated in the Saudi consulate.
Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah. During that time, there was a lot of fear going on. There is a lot of news getting leaked of prisoners being tortured and being mistreated. During that time, my brother was disappeared for 6 months already. And the news I was receiving that my brother was being brutally tortured, that he might die from torture. And their brutality have reached to the point that they broke his hand and smashed his fingers, saying, this is the hand you tweet with, or this is the hand you write with.
How did you find out about his injuries?
There are several witnesses, and also it's confirmed by several human rights organizations that he was really abused in prison and he was brutally tortured.
So you yourself took to Twitter, the same platform your brother used to express your outrage about the whole situation. What was the response there?
Oh, I get threats all the time. I get threats of murder. I get threats of retaliation. As we're speaking right now, I've been receiving a lot of attacks and threats from Saudi-backed Twitter accounts. And some of them are clearly they're linked to the government.
You've been getting these as we've been speaking just now.
Yes.
Arij, what about the possibility of your traveling to Saudi Arabia to see your brother in prison? I mean, is that even on your mind?
Unfortunately, I cannot travel to Saudi Arabia while MBS is actually in power. You can all imagine what would happen to me. They are already calling me a terrorist. They're calling me a traitor. They're calling me a spy and all sort of crazy stuff just because I'm speaking up, you know, against the abuses to my brother and to many others in Saudi Arabia.
Arij Al-Sadan is the sister of Abdulrahman Al-Sadan. This week, a Saudi appeals court upheld his 20-year prison sentence and added on a 20-year travel ban. Arij, thank you very much for speaking with us about your brother.
Thank you so much.
We reached out to the Saudi embassy in Washington for comment, but did not receive a reply in time for this broadcast. These kinds of human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia are well known. That's why people were stunned yesterday when the kingdom's sovereign wealth fund finalized its purchase of the Premier League soccer team, Newcastle United. The fund is worth hundreds of billions of dollars, and Newcastle fans are expecting its new owners to pump a ton of money into the soccer club. But questions remain around how this sale happened in the first place. For more on this, we're joined by Tariq Panja, a global sports reporter for the New York Times. He's based in London. Let's start first of all with the reaction from Newcastle, Tariq. How are fans there taking the sale of their beloved club?
Joy unconfined. These fans were dancing in the streets. It was as though they had won the championship. And what they have, they see, is, as you mentioned, one of the most wealthy funds, if not the wealthiest sovereign investment fund on the planet, coming in and taking over. It points to a brighter future. Whatever the facts are about this regime, it seems to me, I would say sadly, a lot of the fan base simply do not care.
And when you say regime, you're talking about the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, right?
Absolutely.
Well, the Premier League had to approve the sale. Did it take Saudi Arabia's human rights record into consideration?
Not at all. I could speak at length about this, but it's a very short answer because the Premier League simply does not care about that type of thing when it comes to the ownership of its teams. We already have the brother of the ruler of the United Arab Emirates owning the championship winning team at the moment, Manchester City. And this to me speaks to something troubling and strange about soccer and soccer fandom in Europe. It seems in many places, anyone is acceptable, whatever they've done, any type of regime is welcome, provided they come heavily armed with cash.
So we just spoke with the sister of Abdurrahman Al-Sudan. He's going to serve 20 years in prison in Saudi for basically expressing his opinions on Twitter. Are you hearing any criticism in the UK along the lines of Newcastle United sellers are complicit with the human rights abusers in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, you would. Also, soccer is a very tribal sport. So Newcastle is one team in a 20-team league. So for that reason alone, 19 fans of 19 other teams are pointing this stuff out because it's not their team. Apart from that, you know, Amnesty International, Human Rights Group call this out, as well as some pundits in the media. I think this is one of the most important moments in the league's history since it was founded in 1992. The leadership of the Premier League itself has been MIA, has been missing in action. The only comments that have emanated from the league have been a three-paragraph press release saying the deal was done in a way that separates the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia from the Saudi state. Again, that to me is very hard to understand. Journalists, including myself, have tried to probe the Premier League to ask them to explain this. And all we've heard so far are crickets.
What does Saudi Arabia get out of all of this? Why did they want to buy Newcastle United to begin with?
I think they wanted to buy into the Premier League. This is the most watched, the biggest, the most glamorous professional football league in the world. There is, under Mohammed bin Salman, this effort to wean the country of its dependence on oil, to kind of pivot the economy into different directions, into more sectors, with sports and entertainment being something that they are particularly keen on. They've already lured Formula One and golf and tennis events, WWE wrestling to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It was a natural progression that they would look to soccer because it is the world's most popular game. And here they are. We've seen that from the region. And I mentioned the UAE has Manchester City Football Club and also hosts a ton of sports events. This is a path well trodden.
New York Times global sports reporter Tariq Panja speaking with us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. On the outside of a modest brick home in London, there's a small plaque that's just been placed there.
Hopefully people will want to dig below the story and say, oh, who was this person and how did they get here and what was it like for them here?
We'll share you more of their story, formerly enslaved people in Georgia who became leading abolitionists in London. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The top two films in U.S. theaters right now are both Marvel movies, but in China, the biggest film market in the world, everyone's talking about a three-hour-long propaganda film. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai went to see it to understand what the fuss is all about.
It's become a tradition. Every October during the week-long National Day holidays, people in China head to the movies. and there's always a new patriotic flick or two in the mix. This year was no exception. The Battle at Lake Changjin is a Hollywood-style war movie with A-list actors, cutting-edge special effects, and some pretty gruesome fight scenes. It's about a brutal battle of the Korean War, or what is known here in China as the War to Resist U.S. Aggression and Help Korea. The film has raked in the money, setting box office records. The film glorifies the Chinese troops who defeated the Americans in a decisive battle that ended up being a turning point in the war. Unlike Hollywood war movies, there isn't a single protagonist. The heroes are really the soldiers of China's People's Liberation Army, who went off to war without enough warm clothes, food, or weapons in negative 40 degree temperatures. Li Min is a working mom. She says she remembers her grandparents telling her stories about the Korean War, and she wanted to take her 9 and 14-year-old kids to see the movie. It's important for them to remember history, she tells me. Li says she wants her children to understand that everything they have now has been fought for with blood and sweat. Some people I speak with say the movie was a little too Hollywood for their taste, not realistic enough. But most people I talk to say they were truly moved by the film. This is a battle where 50,000 Chinese troops died, either in combat or they froze to death. Wu Xinbo, the director of Fudan University's Center for American Studies, says China's victory came at great cost, and that's something people even now are well aware of.
This battle is always painted as a kind of a symbol of the heroism, the spirit of sacrifice, and the spirit of discipline on the part of Chinese military.
Last year marked the 70th anniversary of the start of the Korean War. Since then, there have been a slew of films, documentaries, and TV series for release in China about the war. Zhao Ma is a professor of Chinese history at Washington University in St. Louis.
The Korean War in Chinese national memory really shifted, you know, to a kind of a nationalist mission. So Chinese state or the party remains at the center in this narrative. So the entire war is kind of just a salute to this glorious Chinese party and glorious Chinese state.
To call Battle at Lake Changjin a propaganda film is not a stretch. It was actually commissioned by the government. Catherine Chu, a political science professor at Cal State, says people in China don't necessarily see propaganda as negative.
We call this as a propaganda film, but I think from the Chinese perspective, they actually see this film as kind of like educational because they thought that they could learn some history about the past of their country.
She says the film taps into nationalist sentiment that the government under Xi Jinping's leadership is trying to foster among young people.
It just kind of like inspired a new generation. You have to do the same thing to defend, to keep China safe.
Watching this film about the start of the Cold War era, it's impossible not to think about the current political standoff between China and the U.S. Zhao Ma from Washington University says this is intentional. The two countries are not at war, of course, but it's no secret that the relationship is deeply fraught.
And so with the tensions with the United States really escalated at a dizzying sort of pace in 2020. You know, the relationship is at free fall and nobody knows where the bottom is.
The historic parallels between the Korean War and the 21st century standoff between the U.S. and China is probably one reason why the film is so popular. Wu Xinbo says this resonates with audiences in China. And the movie also has a pretty clear message for Americans, too.
The U.S. should never underestimate China. Under the U.S. pressure, the Chinese people would even more strongly and firmly support the government and Communist Party. If the U.S. really treat China as a strategic rivalry or even an enemy, I think the U.S. should be prepared to pay a very high price for that.
In other words, remember this moment in history when the American military met Chinese troops on the battlefield and lost. For the world, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
This week, you will find a new plaque marking the home of two American abolitionists, Ellen and William Craft, not in the U.S., but at their former home in London, where they fled to in 1850. That's when Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act, making it legal for the couple to be captured and re-enslaved in the U.S. Martha Cutter is a professor of English and Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. So I understand the Crafts were part of a whole transatlantic abolition movement, Martha. Let's start there. What was that movement? How did it start?
I think it started much earlier than you would think with slaves who escaped from slavery. And even before the Fugitive Slave Law, were worried about recapture. Britain had outlawed slavery gradually, but they wanted to hear stories of individuals who had experienced slavery firsthand. And that created more of a feeling, an emotion about the need to abolish slavery in the United States, as well as in other parts of England where slave colonies continued.
So did the movement have a network of abolitionists on both sides of the Atlantic who were working together to get people freed?
I mean, the Underground Railroad worked to free people, but there was more of a network once you were free. People in the United States who were involved with the abolitionist movement would ask individuals who were former slaves like Frederick Douglass or Moses Roper to become part of their movement. And they would sponsor their speeches and incorporate them into the U.S. abolitionist movement. But there was a pretty robust network between the United States and England of hooking people up to become part of the British abolitionist movement and helping them find places to give talks, find housing, education, generally treated the formerly enslaved individuals quite well.
So tell us more about Ellen and William Craft. I mean, their story of escape from the American South is really remarkable. Where did they come from and how did they make it to the UK in 1850?
Yes, they escaped and they got to the North and were received by members of the Underground Railroad, but it wasn't safe for them in the United States. And in 1850, they fled to England because there was danger of them being recaptured. And they had a long career in England as part of the abolitionist movement and other political movements and didn't come back to the United States until, I think, 1868. So they felt more protected in England and more established. And they didn't come back until not only the end of the Civil War, but also some passage of amendments that secured them freedom.
And Ellen was disguised as a man, a disabled man when she fled, right? That's wild.
Yeah, so Ellen adopted the disguise of a disabled white male, and she was light-skinned, and she could pass for white. And her husband was darker-skinned, and he pretty much pretended to be her servant. And so there was fear. Ellen didn't know how to read and write, and the fact that she couldn't read and write might indicate that she was a slave. So she bound up her arm in a sling. And she also was worried that somebody might see she didn't have whiskers on her chin because, of course, she was a woman. And so she would wear a poultice over her face and say that she had rheumatism. Her husband participates too, you know, pretending to be her devoted servant. And at some point, somebody tries to buy him, saying, "You're such a good servant." And he says, "Oh, I love my master. I would never part with him." But of course, people take that to mean he's a great slave. But he's actually talking about the fact that this is a wife. He's like, you can't buy my affection. And it's because it's his wife and he loves his wife.
Plaques marking the homes of historic figures often go unnoticed. I mean, I find them all the time and I'm struck when I do notice them. What do you hope marking the former home of these abolitionists, Ellen and William Craft in London, what do you hope will make people think about when they see it?
Hopefully people will want to dig below the story and say, oh, who was this person and how did they get here? There's just so many pieces of Black history that have been forgotten and erased. And so when we start to put plaques up, it's just the tip of the iceberg to get people to think about the history that like literally lies under our feet and that the stories have gone untold. Toni Morrison talks about writing the other history because so many people who were enslaved didn't escape from slavery or couldn't tell their stories. So there's a real attempt to kind of get to that other history.
Martha Cutter is a professor of English and Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. She's also the author of The Illustrated Slave, Empathy, Graphic Narrative, and the Visual Culture of the Transatlantic Abolition Movement. Martha, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great talking to you.
People in Iraq are heading to the polls this weekend. They're voting in elections that will determine who gets into parliament. Those lawmakers will help shape the future government of Iraq and determine who becomes president and prime minister. This election is taking place a year earlier than originally scheduled, and that's the result of mass protests that took place in Iraq 2 years ago. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
In October 2019, Via Abbas joined thousands of Iraqis protesting in the streets of Baghdad. Over the next few months, he sent me videos like this one. Young Iraqis marching side by side, waving the Iraqi flag and expressing their anger and frustration towards the government. We stayed in the streets for days, Abbas tells me. We had horrible, sad days, like when we lost our friends. But the protests were also inspiring. We felt freedom like we'd never experienced before, he says. Those demonstrations were the biggest since the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Protesters camped out at one of Baghdad's main squares and stayed there for months. At one point, they even had tents where they cooked meals and treated their wounded. But before too long, Iraqi security forces put an end to it. They killed more than 600 protesters, according to human rights groups. But the demonstrations also brought about some changes.
After only 13 months in office, Iraq's embattled Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi has officially stepped down.
That's when Iraqi officials promised early elections. They also made some changes to Iraq's election laws, allowing more women and independent politicians to run for office. The vote on Sunday is happening because of those protests, but there already seems to be a problem.
What's really important about these elections is the widespread call for boycott.
Taif Al-Khudairi is an Iraq researcher at the London School of Economics.
This comes on the back of the violence that was experienced by protesters during the demonstrations themselves. It also comes on the back of the escalation in violence, particularly the targeted assassinations that we've seen against political activists since the demonstrations have subsided.
A few new political parties emerged out of those protests, she says. But some Iraqis are boycotting these elections because they want to see the people responsible for political assassinations brought to justice. Since 2003, Iraq has held several elections, but politics remained very much centered along ethnic, religious, and sectarian lines. Corruption is rampant, Khodairi says. There are even reports of vote buying in the run-up to this election.
Often these people are very poor, like they'll go to informal settlements, for example, and they'll give out plots of land, food, guns, I read somewhere.
In an attempt to restore faith in the election this year, the United Nations and the European Union are sending monitoring teams. But Mohammed Al-Wa'ili, a political analyst in Baghdad, says there is a general sense of weariness among Iraqis.
It's definitely not the same excitement that existed in the first parliamentary election and also in the second, and probably also the third.
He says a lot of Iraqis no longer believe their vote counts.
I think many people were overly optimistic and thought that change can happen quickly. But the other part, of course, is this definitely because the failures of the political class to provide services.
Besides the lack of services, many Iraqis are calling for an end to foreign involvement. The US has about 2,500 troops in Iraq, and Iran continues to assert its influence in the country. 2 years after he joined the protests in Baghdad, Via Abbas says not much has changed for him and his friends who risked their lives on the streets.
للأسف شاركت بعدة انتخابات لكن هذه الانتخابات أنا من ضمن المقاطعين لها.
He says he has voted in past elections, but this time he's boycotting. The ruling class is not responding to our demands, he tells me. Abbas is 30 years old and works as a lab technician at a hospital.
عمري 30 عام. لست متزوج. أساساً أنا ضد فكرة الزواج وإنشاء عائلة.
He says he lives with his parents and one of his brothers. Another brother decided to immigrate to Europe. Abbas says he would like to get married and settle down one day, but given Iraq's unstable economy, he says that's hard to think about right now.
مطالبنا من الحكومة هي إزاحة الطبقة الحاكمة كاملة.
What we want is to completely remove the ruling class, he says. Iraqis don't have basic necessities like electricity, clean water, and decent roads. How can we go beyond that, he says. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafori.
I love living in the city, but it comes with certain sacrifices, like at 2 a.m. on a Sunday when I'm sleeping and hear this. Usually it's the students living down the street, but if I were in China, it could just as easily be so-called dancing grannies, groups of senior citizens, mostly women, who gather in public squares to dance to the music. And it is loud, blasted over tinny speakers. This movement has its roots in the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s and 70s. The women say it's a healthy way of socializing and keeping fit. But not everyone's so enamored, especially when competing groups of dancers blast their music over each other in the same small space. There are videos on social media of some guys playing basketball in a park, but then a group of grannies takes over the court. It's not pretty. Some of the young people report to state media and online feeling too intimidated to confront these elderly dancers. Enter a solution, at least for their immediate concerns. It looks like a flashlight, but it's actually a remote control that works over long distances. You can point it at a speaker hundreds of feet away and just shut it off without anyone knowing who did it. A video went viral on Weibo this week, showing a man pointing this device out his apartment window at two groups of dancing grannies on the street below. All right, there's a music bed under this video, so you can't tell, but trust me, the grannies' music stops, and they all look around, confused, trying to figure out what happened. Reading the social media comments, one user of this remote device wrote that it is the perfect solution, a way to stop the music and avoid the wrath of the grannies in one fell swoop. Yeah, it's passive-aggressive. Still, I wonder if they ship to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Those MIT and Harvard students who like blaring their music at 2 a.m., they won't know what hit them. The Congo rainforest is the second largest in the world. It plays a big role in capturing and storing carbon dioxide. But new policy measures in the Democratic Republic of the Congo have some people there worried about the health of their rainforest. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
Nearly 20 years ago, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, took a radical step. The government effectively put a moratorium on timber logging in the Congo rainforest. The aim was to give the DRC a chance to come up with a sustainable plan to manage its forest resources and prevent a free-for-all logging spree. But now the DRC is planning to remove that measure in order to develop its industrial logging sector as a way to generate revenue. That's got a lot of people concerned, including Sergei Sabine Ngwato of Greenpeace Africa. He's based in the DRC's capital, Kinshasa.
Nous pensons que cette décision est une menace.
Ngwato says it's a bad decision for the Congo rainforest and for the millions of people who depend on it. The forest has already suffered from deforestation due to the charcoal industry. Ngwato says he worries that the move will lead to exploitation and deforestation by multinational corporations, but the existing moratorium has not actually stopped logging. Activists say some companies have continued operating illegally thanks to corrupt officials. Still, Ngwato says ending the moratorium will just make things worse and, in his words, bring a climate catastrophe.
Nous les avons exhorté à ce qu'ils doivent veiller.
He tells me Greenpeace and some 40 other organizations are calling on foreign donors to withhold financial support if the DRC lifts its logging ban. This comes at a time when the country is seeking $1 billion in funding to protect its forests. And as the DRC prepares for the upcoming UN Climate Change Conference in Scotland.
Je souhaitais que la République démocratique du Congo, en tant que nation, ait un seul son de cloche.
In August, environmental official Constantine Quette said the DRC needs to be unified as the government seeks climate financing to protect its forest. The DRC has shot back at critics, questioning why other countries can benefit from the Congo rainforest, but not the DRC. Sergei Obundu is with the Forest Governance Observatory, a local environmental NGO.
On peut effectivement commencer à discuter de manière tranquille sur la levée
He says the DRC can start talking about lifting the logging ban, but only once the government takes steps to improve forest management. And it's taking a few already. The DRC is looking at creating a carbon tax and a national forest policy.
Pour moi, tout ce que les communautés forestières demandent, qu'elles soient pygmées.
Obundu says local communities also have a right to the forest resources, and better policies will help them too. Vikarba Tundihangi is an advocate for the indigenous forest communities. He argues that there are better ways to generate revenue.
On préserve nos forêts, mais on investit dans la promotion du tourisme.
He points to tourism as an example. That helps the economy, but doesn't have to hurt the forest. But the DRC's parliament has already approved a measure to end the ban on industrial logging. And last week, the government said it has no intention of renegotiating its decision with anyone. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Finally today, a hit from 1824 that's still making the rounds. Ode to Joy from Ludwig von Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It was the German composer's final completed work, until now. As The World's Bianca Hillier reports, Beethoven is back with a little help from modern technology.
When Beethoven died nearly two centuries ago, he had hundreds of compositions to his name. But one was still in the works, his 10th symphony.
Beethoven left some material for the 10th symphony in terms of some sketches and also some writing, a little writing about some ideas. But some of them is as short as 2-3 seconds.
That's Ahmed Ilgamel. He has spent the last couple of years poring over Beethoven's notoriously sloppy writing, trying to see if there was enough there to harmonize and orchestrate the unfinished 10th symphony. But Ilgamel isn't a composer or music historian. He's a professor of computer science at Rutgers University.
But I have a big passion for classical music and Beethoven.
Ilgamel is part of a team of scientists and musicians who have been trying to use artificial intelligence to finish Beethoven's final work. Computational music expert Mark Gotham was on board too. He says from the get-go, they knew it was no easy task.
This is kind of technical and musical and creative and computational challenge all at once.
Artificial intelligence can seem untouchable to those of us who don't understand its inner workings. But Ilgamel says AI can predict music notes just like your phone or email tries to predict what you're going to type next.
The AI is learning what would be the next word because it already had been exposed to a lot of text. So it can predict basically what is the next word from the previous words.
The team exposed the AI to all of Beethoven's previous works, plus the classical music he likely would have been listening to at the time. A little bit of Bach, Mozart, and Haydn, for example. They also taught the AI how Beethoven constructed his fifth symphony out of this basic four-note motif. Simply put, Ilgamel and the team put this AI through the ringer. And finally, after years of countless iterations and diligent coding, they printed the score and sent it off to an orchestra.
It sounds so Beethoven to me. For me, it feels like I'm listening to something like one of the symphonies of Beethoven that I'm used to. It sounds like so realistic.
As impressive and beautiful as it is, this is just a preview. The team fully orchestrated two entire movements at more than 20 minutes each. They're being released tomorrow. In the end, Ilgamel says the AI is not the artist here. It's just a tool. And he thinks Beethoven would be pleased with the result.
I think the fact that 200 years after his death, to have a group of people using the state-of-the-art technology to try to match his genius, that would make him proud of what he did. So I guess he's happy.
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We thank you for being with us. Stay safe, be relaxed, have a great weekend, and we'll see you again Monday.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world. From PR.